The widespread closing of venues and cancellations of shows has abruptly halted the vibrant Twin Cities live music industry. Without knowing when we can gather again, XL Energy Center and Michelob Golden Light have partnered to bring awareness to the needs of those significantly impacted by this shutdown. Songs for the Cities supports the Twin Cities Music Community Trust, whose vision is to provide assistance to the local live music industry workforce. Visit XLEnergyCenter.com to learn more and to make a donation. Now, let's listen to Songs for the Cities featuring our host, Chris Hockey.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode number 3 of Songs for the Cities, brought to you by XL Energy Center and Mick Golden Light. My name is Chris Hockey. We're here raising money to help the Twin Cities community of musicians and people who help put on the live shows that you love so much that you're missing right now. Well, guess what? They're missing it as well, and they're missing the income from that. So as you can see, as you clicked here at XLEnergyCenter.com, there's a donate now button. Please, if you got a dollar to spare, if you got $100 to spare, they'd love it. We'd love it. Just click the donate now button. But if you got nothing to spare, we get that as well. We're glad you're here to listen. Welcome to Songs for the Cities, episode 3. And a very special one today, somebody I'm looking forward to getting to know a little bit better. Somebody I've known on the periphery and talked to quite a few times, but really don't know a lot about in depth. And that's Julius Collins, who's on the phone right now. Julius, how are you, buddy?
I'm well, Seahawk. Good to talk to you there.
I appreciate you giving me the time this afternoon and taking the time to be a part of this. Let me ask you, amongst all the millions of things going on that is different in your life right now, how much are you missing performing live?
It's interesting. I miss it. I mean, this seems kind of meh, but I enjoy the break from it, but I miss it in terms of the release element of it. You know what I mean? The feeling of, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but you know what I'm talking about, that
sure.
Feeling of you getting your yayas out and afterward you feel like a human being again. I miss the exercise of it, and of course I miss the camaraderie of it.
For a lot of us, and I've talked to a couple of people about this, having a break is something that you are afraid to take. It's something you really can't afford to take. When you're forced to take one, it kind of resets the mind. So it's going to be interesting to step on stage for the first few times after this to see how it feels to walk back out there again.
You know what it's like, man. And performing for forever. And even now, before I do it, I have like a mini anxiety attack. It's like, can I do this?
Yeah.
And so I think that's going to be heightened on some level. And then there's just going to be the over-aggressive nature of wanting to get after it again. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out. I won't be in any hurry to do it until things are safe enough to feel good about doing it. You know what I mean?
Julius, tell me if you would, really quickly, for people who are unfamiliar with your work or just slightly familiar with it. I know you do a lot of things in the theater as well. Tell me, how many different products are you a part of when everything is moving right now? How many shows are you doing as far as in the theater with a band per month?
Well, there were a couple shows that just obviously are canceled now. So frankly, I'm looking at my life as a clean slate going on beyond this, except for a couple of projects that were in the works.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing some writing and recording again with my old band Greasy Meal. And I think we'll be featuring one of their songs on the show experience today. And I'm also working with another band called The Sweat Band. And it's a group of young cats who are just up and coming, really talented musicians, songwriters. And so that'll be my focus, a lot of original stuff. But, I play with Dr. Mambo's Combo every week. And for me, that's the way I exercise my instrument. I hang out with my favorite musicians and we play music. And so, all these things will be back in play. And then the theater part of that kind of like, everybody's reshuffling schedules in that regard.
Sure. Have you been doing the combo thing for 20 years? Is that right?
I started with the combo when I moved here in 91, a couple months after I moved here.
Nope.
And this is like my third tour of duty with the combo because I've gone away, you're on the road or whatever for a while. Greasy Meal was playing on Sundays at the Caboose for a few years there. So I've taken time off from time to time, but it's like my home base, Bunkers and Michael Bland and Billy Franzi and Margaret Cox and Kevin Gastonway and Sonny Thompson. It's like going to the gym, getting a great workout, and afterwards you just feel depleted, but you feel like a million bucks. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Tell me about what you love about that room, Bunkers.
Well, it's there are a lot of great rooms here in town. They really are. But Bunkers, I have a special place in my heart for Bunkers. It is my home. You know what I mean? The owners, Jackie and Jimmy, you know, they kind of took me in, and the band took me in there when I was just a kid coming up here to check it out, and I found out it was Prince's favorite band, so I had immediate connection to Prince, and it's kind of how I ended up here. I mean, he was managing a band called Black Julius that Michael Bland and I were running, and so I just was kind of folded into a lot of what was going on, and I think because of being at Bunkers and being around Bland, I felt like a lot of the people that the great majority of the people that I know today, I met almost immediately as a function of that.
Yeah, for sure. And then talking about Greasy Mail and talking about the Caboose, another great storied room here in the Twin Cities. Tell me what you love about that place.
You know, I love the Caboose. I just have so many unbelievable memories there with Greasy Mail. Greasy Mail was a phenomenon. And I would say that if I wasn't in the band, it was just, I mean, sometimes I would just, I was perplexed at how 1,000 people every single Sunday would come into that joint and be energized. But I have to admit, it does give me a great sense of pride because I knew we were playing for the right reasons. And then we were smart enough to write material, our own original material, to kind of go on beyond that. And so the Caboose is just, Bunkers and the Caboose, those are institutions. I mean, maybe not in the way that First Avenue is an institution, but they're music institutions that are world famous. You know, people all over the world know about Bunkers. They know about the Caboose, and of course they know about First Avenue.
Yeah, you know, speaking of Greasy Meal, by the way, and I know a lot of people out there are going to be excited to hear you say that you might be working on some music with them again, but I have a very good friend, one of my best friends, as a matter of fact, Tony Stemper. When I told him I was doing this interview today, he said at the final Greasy Meal show, he caught a taco. What in the world? What is he talking about?
Man, listen, we were out of hand, just a bunch of freaks. And we, you know, I just think as a rule, pushing the envelope. When Greasy Mill first started, we were a cover band, and there was a song. The band itself had done this project for the sax player, who is my late friend Brian Gallagher. He had a song on the record called Greasy Mill, so they decided they put a band together, and Brian and I were in a band called the TC Jammers, and we were getting disenchanted about the same time and bonding over our disenchantment. And he said, hey, you want to play with a band at the Caboose? We've got 4 gigs booked, and it's called Greasy Mill. And I said, it's a horrible name, but he started listening to people in the band, and I said, I'm in. And we had 4 Sundays booked. And so instead of trying to be crowd pleasers, we were going deep catalog on everything. And it really touched a nerve. I mean, people who lived through those era were playing a lot of 70s stuff, and people who were bringing their kids, and it was just like it was a phenomenon. And we were all lazy, and, you know, we did a lot of inhaling of cannabis, mm-hmm. brought us a couch on stage, so mm-hmm. people would come on stage and sit on the couch while we were playing. It was awesome. I called it the Davenport of Love. And then we just got the idea we had this tune called The Urban Herbalist, and it was an instrumental jam. And during it, we would throw out bean burritos from Taco Bell around the corner. And so that's Greasy Meal in a nutshell, man.
Dude, that's so great, though. Hey, let me ask you a side note on this. You've talked about two of the most famous weekly gigs in the history of the Twin Cities, and you've been part of both of them. What do you like about having a weekly gig at the same spot?
I like playing. I mean, I enjoy playing music. I enjoy singing. I enjoy the feeling that comes from it. It's like your endorphins. It's like all that good feeling that comes out and all that negativity that leaves you. And, you know, it can get pretty negative out there. And for me, music and working out have been the things that have kept me from choking people out. So I missed the therapy.
Yeah. Yeah, I can feel you on that. And I want to talk about choking people out as well, because I want to know about how you growing up. And I'd been told by our mutual friend, Paul Allen, that you were a wrestler at one time. But let's go ahead and go there now. Let's take a step back in time and learn about Julius Collins. Where are you from originally?
Well, I was born in Chicago.
Okay.
I come from a pretty messed up family. I ended up in a foster home in the foster care system in Waterloo, Iowa. Mm. That's where I grew up and went to school. And, you know, I did wrestle growing up in Iowa. It was, you know, you're a wrestler, you're a farmer, and sometimes you're both. And so I enjoyed wrestling because it was like chess, only physically.
Yeah.
And so I enjoy that kind of mano-y-mano kind of experience. But I grew up in the foster care system, and it was a couple homes, and then I moved with my mom my senior year of high school, and I was just ready to get out of Waterloo and see what the world had to offer. I went to Atlanta as a teenager to go to a school called the Music Business Institute. And it's kind of opened up my eyes to all that is the music industry and how I could function in it. But I discovered pretty quickly I didn't love the industry as much as I loved the art, and I just had to find a way over the years to kind of marry the two, because they're sometimes incompatible.
When you're a wrestler, when you're in Waterloo, when do you realize that you can sing?
Oh, I realized I could sing long before I could, I knew I was a wrestler, that's for sure. I grew up in a old school gospel church.
Okay.
And, a lot of the people in Waterloo, especially the older people, migrated there for jobs on their way to Chicago, and some of them just stopped in Waterloo, stopped in Iowa. So it was a really, like, old school, the first church that I belonged to, man, it had an outhouse.
Wow.
And I remember the march up Ash Street to the Sumner's, Ash Street, yeah, to the new church. But, it was old school church, and there's a lot of great soloists. And so, there's just a lot of great influences up and down the ladder. And then when I got into school in third grade, who, by the way, still comes and hears me sing, which I love her so much. She was the one who really made me feel like I had a gift, because I never sang as a soloist in church before third grade. In third grade, I met Mrs. Western, and then she stopped class and said, "You have a gift, young man." And so I spent a lot of time with Miss Western after class. In between classes, it was like my safe zone as a kid, as a foster kid. I felt invisible for the lion's share of in my childhood. When she kind of reached out to me, it made me feel like a human being. It's hard to explain, but my first solo was third grade, and she featured me. It was Ben. Remember Ben by Michael Jackson?
Oh, of course, yeah. Yeah, of course.
So, I was just a little dude in my plaid suit singing Ben, but it was like it opened up a portal for me. And that was kind of a life. Music and singing and sports have been the thing. And then, of course, my family. But before that, those are the things that kind of kept me from going nutty.
What years do you get to Atlanta?
I got to Atlanta in 84.
Wow. Okay.
So 84.
This is, we're talking.
Right? No, that's not right.
Okay.
I got to Atlanta, yeah, in 84, 85, right in there.
Okay. Because we're talking about the birth of a lot of really different, varied styles of music in that era in Georgia. And, of course, we can talk about Athens and REM, but there's a lot of different music in the area that you were going to. When you got down there, did it blow your mind a little bit, or was it not quite burgeoning yet?
It did not blow my mind.
Huh.
It wasn't quite there yet.
Okay.
It didn't get there, I think, until after I left. Atlanta was an amazing city to live in. It was beautiful, and for me as a black man, it was amazing to see black people in all different walks of life and government and business, and I thought, wow, this is a beautiful city. You can get an awesome meal at any time of the day. But when I was there were only a handful of places that were viable musical outlets. There was The Point, and there was Rays on the River and Cafe 290, and a couple of rock bars. I used to love to go to one rock bar. I can't remember the name of it. It was in Buckhead, and there was a band called Sexual Chocolate. And it was just a bunch of white dudes, man, but they were awesome. But every single gig, it was two dudes who were brothers in the band, and they would get into a knockdown fight every time I watched them play. It was just awesome. But Atlanta was like a Rupert's town. Did you ever see the Rupert's that was up here?
I did not, no, huh?
Okay, right there at 394 and where is that? Right there where it gets to 100. I'm talking about the Metropolitan?
Yeah, right where I'm sitting right now at the Metropolitan, right across the street from us, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the Metropolitan used to be called the Rupert's Nightclub.
Okay.
And it had a couple sister clubs, one in Atlanta, and then we opened another one in St. Louis.
Wow.
And the one in Atlanta was identical to the one here, only, I think, three or four times larger. It was enormous. So imagine the Metropolitan three times larger. That was the Atlanta Club. Atlanta was like sort of where they bring a lot of the VIPs down there, but a few of the bar staff people and a couple of the singers and players would come down every now and then. That's where I met Debbie Duncan and Gwen Matthews and Mark Licktide and Brian Kinney and a lot of the singers from up here, and they all, including the bar staff, they're like, man, you got to get up to Minneapolis. It's your kind of city. It's your kind of scene. And I grew up in Iowa, man. I had no real interest in coming back to cold weather, extended cold weather. I mean, you got a month of it in Atlanta, but I wanted something different, because in Atlanta I was starting to feel like a robot. There was no real. I think Atlanta at that time wanted to be LA too bad, so it was just so many factions, and there was no sense in my mind of community like there is in the Twin Cities. In the Twin Cities, people go off on world tours, and you know this to be true, and they come back and they play on the scene. So what it does is it elevates the water level. I think people in the Twin Cities have a higher collective musical IQ. I just think, what the hell else are we going to do in the winter? We're going to work on our crafts, you know what I mean? So, but I didn't really think about those things. I just thought about the snow. But I came up to visit. I'd heard Prince's favorite band played at this place called Bunkers. And so I came up, and sure enough, the first night I was in town, it was like some friends took me down to Bunkers, and I just remember seeing like 15 Harleys out front, man. It used to be like Bunkers used to be like the Caboose, and what's the place next to Caboose? I can't think of right now. Just Biker Bar.
Yeah, yeah.
Straight up. And so I was like, man, where are y'all taking me? Am I going to have to fight my way out of this joint? We go inside, and sure enough, the bar is just lined with like the most murderous looking dudes you've ever seen in your life. Hardcore bikers. But the crowd was like black people, white people, gay people, straight people, people in Birkenstocks and tie-dye, brothers in fedoras. I was like, what on earth is this? And I think it really was my idea of heaven. And it wasn't even 5 minutes after getting there, man. Here comes Prince and Sheila E. up on stage to sit in with the band. I thought, wow. And the people that I was with were trying to tell the band, I need you to sit in. And the guy comes over to me and says, I'd love for you to sit in tonight, man, but Prince is sitting in. I was like, all right, man, no problem. But I came back the next night and I sat in, and I was sold on what my path was going to be, at least in terms of the art, the music part of it. You know, the business part of it, I really was disenchanted. But right about then, Prince signed us to a management deal with Paisley, and that was a lot less fun than you would think.
Okay, let's talk about that too. But quickly, can you, and I want to make sure people know the time frames we're talking about. So when did you walk into that club for the first time? What year were you talking about there?
That was 91.
That was 91, okay. So
that was 91 when I walked into Bunkers, yeah.
Gotcha.
Because it was the year we got that freaking Halloween
snowstorm. Yeah, okay, right. Yeah, welcome back to Minnesota. Welcome back to
Yeah, it right. was like, wow, this is unbelievable, man.
So you go in, and I'm guessing Michael Bland is on drums. I mean, you got the classic lineup of the combo right there. And the first night you sing on stage with them, was it magical?
It was unbelievable. It was like, you know, I played music. I had my first band when I was, you know, in fifth and sixth grade. And those were good little musicians. And over the years, I've been in bands with, like, there would always be, like, a virtuoso, maybe two in the band. You know what I mean? There were always guys like, this drummer is otherworldly, or this keyboard, you know what I mean? It was the first time I'd heard that kind of collective genius and, frankly, like, reckless, like, pushing up the envelope, that I just had never heard music play that aggressively and that with that much precision and thought. And I just getting to sing with that band, it was incredible. I even now I can still remember that feeling going, I can't go back to what I was doing. Right. I can't go back to that feeling that I was experiencing. Because whenever I play with people who really like invest to that degree, it is just, it's a spiritual feeling. It's tremendous.
Was there any trepidation about walking onto that stage for the first time? Were you scared to death?
No, I think I was too young to be scared.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, I wanted to show them what I could do. But at the same time, like I said, I have a little anxiety attack before I sing, even now. It's just something that happens. But, I think it helps me. It means that I care. At least that's the way I've rationalized it. Right. But, no, I wasn't scared because, you know, I knew I could hold my own. But I was just surprised that, you know, they had a sixth gear, You know, some bands get you to third gear. Some bands got a strong fourth gear. The combo has a fifth and a sixth gear. And I was like, wow, it was like taking off. It was like rocket fuel.
Isn't it wonderful to have that, Julius, in the fact that, you know, I always say this to people, the one thing in my life that's never let me down is my voice. And I am nervous before I go on stage, but I know if you give me a shot, I've always felt like I've always just wanted you to give me a chance. And if you give me a chance, I feel like I can stand up to it. And it sounds like that's what you're talking about as well.
Yeah, I think a funny comedian always knows they're funny when they realize it. They're not afraid to kind of express it. It's a very lonely feeling being a singer. You know, it's lonely being out in that mat by yourself. But eventually you develop a kind of resilience and a belief. Now, there's a lot of denial going on out there in the arts.
Sure, you know what I mean? Yeah.
But the real truth is you know, we won the lottery, Seahawk, you know what I mean? And in that way, we owe it to ourselves to, you know, be as good as we can be all the time. And it helps to be blessed with a strong instrument.
You said you got signed to a management contract from Prince's company. Who all was involved in that management? Was that a Mambo's Combo that got signed to that, or who was it?
No. I had a funk and roll band with Michael Bland called Black Julius.
Okay.
And it was really, I mean, we were insane. I mean, Greasy Meal was a different kind of a thing. Greasy Meal was hippie insane. Greasy Meal, Black Julius was, nobody would come closer than like 15 feet to the stage. We used a lot of pyro. Costumes. It was a four piece rock band, and we were vicious. And you know, because Michael was with MPG at the time, he was with Prince. That was kind of just a natural thing. And then at the time, we were also being schmoozed by Columbia Records. And guess who was doing the schmoozing? Randy Jackson.
Really?
From American Idol. He was the like vice president or president of A&R for Columbia or something like that years ago. So
Wow. It's
just funny. He was a weird, creepy dude to go to dinner with.
I can buy that. And that's after, of course, he'd been playing bass with Journey, and now he's back playing bass with Journey.
But yeah, he's back with him now, right?
Yeah. Just saw that. So did you sign a record deal? Did you put out a record? Tell me about what happened there.
We signed, did not ever, the whole thing. Okay, we signed with the management team, and we were going to sign with Columbia. Then Randy took a different gig, and then that whole thing went to hell. So we just kept writing, and we must have written 30 songs, right at 30 songs. I mean, we were out there at Paisley. We were at the Metro, the old Metro studio. We did a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. But Prince is, he's a genius man, but he was a competitive guy. And Bland and I were really, really tight. And I just think that in my mind, I just think that he didn't really love the fact that his guy was with me. I mean, I heard about it a couple of times, but I mean, honestly, we had a couple gigs where we'd have a gig scheduled, big show scheduled, and he'd schedule a video shoot. We'd have to cancel it. But it was just one of those things for me. It was a reminder of how much the business can be, icky. Because writing with Michael Bland, I must have written 50, 60 songs with that guy over the years, it's not just incredible, it's educational. You know, he's the brightest musician I've ever encountered. And, you know, that part, you know, is one of those life experiences that, you know, I'm really happy that I've had. The business part of it just got icky. Same with Greasy Meal. I mean, I just sometimes when record labels get involved, there's an inherent fear with A&R people, and they kind of are scared of anything that, well, I shouldn't say anymore because the industry is very different anymore, but back then, a black rock band was scary. You had In Living Color, and then there wasn't a lot of other examples of a black rock band. Well, Greasy Meal was, you know, a very different looking band optically, but it was just a unique group of characters who had really high musical IQs and just really loved pushing the envelope. But at the time, there was no space. Now there's space for bands like that. There's Wolfpack, and there's Corey Wong, and there's all these bands that are like really great bands. They have great songs, but they also are great jam bands. And at that point, record labels were tricky. They wanted to split the band up, and they wanted to change the name, and it just created tumult. So I think that was, for Greasy Meal, the end of that part of our journey. We stopped playing for a couple of years, and then we came to our senses, and then we play reunion shows, and now, you know, we've gotten into a situation where, you know, songwriting is something that appeals to us. So that's where we're at. And of course, songwriting with those guys is also just incredibly cool.
No, there's nothing more magical, man, than creating a song with people you love that didn't exist 15 minutes before you sat down. I love that whole feeling. But real quick, one more thing, and then I want to get to playing some of these songs. Being so close to your dream and then having things fall apart, how do you prevent that from breaking your heart, or did it and you just recovered?
You know, it's like being in the business is a death by a thousand cuts. And there's sometimes in the sports analogy is, would you rather get blown out or would you rather lose close?
Right.
And honestly, I don't know how I feel either way. They both hurt. But I've had a handful of these experiences that I think over time you kind of toughen up about it. But for me, I don't have the stomach for it. So I've gravitated away from the business over the years because I just don't have this. I couldn't be an actor in LA where you're going to audition after audition after audition after. You have to have a really strong, you know, continence. Otherwise, it's gonna break you down. For me, you know, it got into my head over time. I had this gig with this band called Sonia Dada. Do you remember Sonia Dada?
Absolutely,
Chicago band.
Sure. 100%. Yes.
Okay. It was three brothers, who were discovered singing in the subway in Chicago, and one of those dudes had a drug problem, and so they hit me up to join the band. I joined the band, rehearsed with them all summer, and at the end of the summer, we were going to go on tour with Traffic. The first gig with Traffic, opening up for Traffic, was going to be at the Target Center here in Minneapolis.
Oh, wow.
So after my summer in downtown Chicago, I was coming home victoriously with a new band that was great. It was hot. I was excited to be in it. The day we were scheduled to come home, the guy who was in charge of the band called me in and said, "This is going to break my heart, man, because we love you so much, but we're going to give Sam one more chance." It was heartbreaking. But, you know, it is what it is. But for me, in the end, when I leave this planet, excited that I've had the chance to make original music. I'm excited that I can leave words and melodies and songs for my grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, so they can have a sense of what I wrote about and what I was thinking about on my time on this planet. You know what I mean? So for me, it's still winning because all that does is inspire a song or an emotion while you're performing.
Keep feeding the river, right? And by the way, Sonia Dada was like the lover, lover, lover. You don't
dream. That's right.
Yeah, right. No kidding. Wow.
That's
dude.
Right. Yeah.
What a fascinating life, man. There's a book or two or four inside you, man. You got to sit down and write that at some point. I wish I had all day to talk to you about it. I literally could. Let me instead go ahead and talk to you and play some of your music. Could you please tell me which song you want me to play first and tell me a little bit about it?
Well, sure. Go ahead and play the Sons of Almighty song first. We talked about my time with Michael Bland. In fact, you know, he for me is my greatest musical hero, inspiration, my longest friend since I've been in town. But when I first moved here, I didn't have a job. My wife was 7 months pregnant, and he was trying to con me into staying in Minnesota. I loved it here, but I just didn't know how I was going to make it work. And so he didn't drive, so I drove him everywhere. For me, I thought it was going to be an easy gig. But because of the fact he doesn't sleep and Prince doesn't sleep, so I was constantly back and forth out to Paisley. It was insane. But the musical experience, riding in with him in that car, I mean, was unbelievable. It was life-altering, right? So, but we'd also, from time to time, talk about our gospel, our backgrounds in gospel. And so we'd do this game where we try to outdo each other who knew the most hymns, old-school hymns.
Okay.
And so we always talked about maybe one day doing a gospel record. And so we did a gospel record, but with our funk. I mean, this is Prince's, this is the MPG rhythm section with Jeff Lee Johnson and me. And it's a very funky approach to gospel. This song is called, I think this song is called
Thy
Kingdom Come.
Yeah. Thy Kingdom Come. Let's play it right now.
Will you be there with me in the sweet by and by? Lightning from west to east. When time subsides, the end of the age has come. And now the world will see our time.
about Abraham, where his disciples came to him, posing the question, Lord, Lord, when will the end be? And Jesus said, be careful that you are not deceived.
I don't even know what to say about that. Julius Collins and Sons of Almighty and Thy Kingdom Come. What an all-star band. What a funk. What a feel. What a sound. I don't know how that's not selling 4 billion copies around the planet. Julia, I mean, honestly, when you finish something like that, don't you just walk away and go, okay, well, there you go. Here's my bank account. Just start throwing money in there.
I think I feel that way every time I cut something. I'm that full of myself. But, and listen, man, I've cashed some checks in the mail. It's a beautiful thing. You know what that's like. But
sure.
In terms of, like, breaking the bank, that has not been hasn't happened for me that way. But the songs, you know, you put the energy and the care into your songs, and then you can walk away and say, if somebody gives me $1 billion for it, that's awesome. And if not, I put $1 billion worth of care into it.
Yeah, it truly is that way, isn't it? I mean, you're so proud. You'll never be less proud, regardless if one person hears it or 50 million people hear it. You'll always love that song.
Yeah, it's about endeavoring to step on that ledge and risk something. And if you're risking it with other people, you know, you just have all those experiences in your head every time you hear it. So, yeah, it's just a wonderful thing to write music, man. It is. It's freedom.
Again, you're listening to Songs for the Cities. This is Julius Collins that we're talking to right now. And don't forget, thanks to our friends at Mick Golden Light and the XL Energy Center, you can support Twin Cities Music Community Trust right now by hitting the Donate Now button and help people, not just the musicians who aren't working, but also the people who run the lights, the people who run the sound, the people who work the bar at your favorite venue. These people are struggling right now like so many, and if you have a dollar that could help, that would be great. If you have $100, even better. But if you don't, we're just glad to have you here listening to the life story, a small version of the life story and the great music of Julius Collins. So thank you to XL Energy Center and Mick Golden Light for making this possible. Let's move on to your next song. Tell me a little bit about what we're going to play next.
Okay. Well, I think Greasy Meal fans would probably roll their eyes at this selection, but it's from our last CD. Greasy Meal had four CDs. It's from our last CD. It's a song called "I Can See It Too." It's a very special song, my wife's favorite, and so this one is Greasy Meal. Like was a lot, I think when people think of Greasy Meal, they think sweaty bodies, a lot of jumping, and long jammed out situations. And this is just a love song.
I Can See It Too, featuring Julius Collins on the vocals.
I'm depending on you to reach across the night and pull me through. You depend on me, but ain't you sick of waiting around just for me? Because you can see the fruit in life. Say I ought to reach right for the vine. Baby, you like it when Minnesota snow keeps falling on down. It would be much warmer, baby, if you were. But that's me relying on you to help me see my future clear too. If I could lose
again, Julius Collins is my guest here on Songs for the Cities. Interesting, before you played that fantastic song, you said that Greasy Meal fans may roll their eyes. Why'd you say that?
Well, I mean, I don't want to try to get too much into other people's heads, but I think when people think of Greasy Meal, they think of songs like Unfaithful and Beat and I Can't Wait. PA plays I Can't Wait at the end of his shows.
Sure.
They think of, you know, I Can See It Too is not a song we played. I think we maybe played it one time. But it's from that last CD, and I happen to think the last one we did, in the mid-2000s was our best work. I felt like all the egos or any kind of problems that might have happened, even accidentally, all that was out the window. It was just truly a group collaborative effort. And I remember cutting this one out in L.A., and I was out there with John Fields and Ken Chastain, and so the three of us were working, and I put the lead down, and took a nap, which I love to do in the studio. It's my favorite place to nap, and woke up, and they had done those background vocals, and it's just really, I mean, it's just why you love playing music with people who can do amazing things.
You mentioned it earlier, man, but and of course you can throw yourself in, and I throw you in with this group, but the amount of talent in this area is unbelievable. Just a few names you've mentioned in passing. We talked a lot about Michael Bland, but I've had the honor of writing songs with that guy and the horror of singing in front of him in the studio because the guy's got perfect pitch and he doesn't have to say anything. He just gives you that look and you know you got to sing it again. And then you talk
annoying.
Yeah, exactly. But it's also inspiring because if I do something that he likes, I feel like I won the freaking lottery, if you know what I mean.
Now, yeah, absolutely. Now, that's how I feel.
Yeah.
He has made me feel like I'm his in that regard. I mean, I've done so much with him over the years, and I've had other projects where I've just brought him in just as to either help co-produce or to play. He's just a resource that is, if Michael Bland, like I can't remember if it was Pern or who with Soul Asylum who said, if you, Michael Bland doesn't join your band, you join him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's because in the end, the guy is—it's not just perfect pitch. His application in the studio. He's not just a drummer. He's a music mind, and it's serious stuff. And John Fields is very much that way. They're like catalogs. They understand the whole history of music and how to use this from this and that. It's a fascinating time to just be able to hang out with these dudes in the studio. So yeah, I know that feeling because working with Michael and being in the studio with him and being in close quarters with him, I realized that standards matter and they're essential.
Yeah, boy, that's a great way to say it. That is a great way to say it. Julius Collins has been my guest on Songs for the Cities, and I've just really, really enjoyed this. But let me take you in a complete direction away from you for 1 second and talk about the music that you love. Tell me about a moment where you were standing in the audience, not on stage, but standing in the audience. Tell me a magical moment you witnessed as a fan.
Okay, I'll give you two real quick ones.
Please.
Stevie Wonder is my favorite artist of all time. And so I went to see Stevie Wonder with my girlfriend at the time, and she wasn't exactly the most fun person to hang out with anyway. But we got into the concert, and it was freaking Stevie Wonder at the Fox Theater in Buckhead, downtown Atlanta, I forget. And Stevie was crushing. He was just killing it, right? And there was a part of the show, like middle of the show, was just Stevie on the keys by himself, singing, just going in and out of songs. It was like the coolest thing I'd ever experienced. And my girlfriend has a headache and she's laying on the seat and I didn't give a shit. I couldn't care less. I was standing up. I was crying. It was magical. That was Stevie Wonder, Fox Theater, Atlanta. A few years later, my wife and I live near Piedmont Park in Atlanta. You know where that is? You heard of it?
I've heard of it. I don't know where it's at.
Okay, well, it's in Midtown, essentially.
Okay.
And so it's big, great big park, and I was just kind of cruising around the park, and she was there with her friends, and I was just kind of there by myself. And it was the first time I heard America.
Oh.
The band America.
Yeah, right, okay.
And it was unbelievable. It was just like a bunch of hippies, and so I took a squad, and we were passing a joint, and it was my first time ever really hearing that kind of music. But they were bad, man. They were really musical. That was a freaking, to this day, one of the top five concerts I've ever seen. America in Piedmont Park for free. It was awesome.
I love that, man. That's great. Well, I'll tell you, again, as I've said a couple of times, Julius, I could spend all day talking to you about this, and I do hope at some point we get a chance to just roll tape and just sit and talk music at some point, because I could do this all day. I think your voice is unbelievable. I can't believe the soul, the love, the heart. I can hear God when you sing, man, and that's the highest compliment.
That goes two ways, bro. Well, I mean that sincerely, and I want to say this really quickly. I know you're against the clock, but I really appreciate you donating a song for the hurricane relief thing that we did. That was just really cool of you to even consider it, but more importantly, show up at the concert. That was really awesome.
Well, I appreciate being asked, man. And
I mean,
anytime.
I hardly knew you, man, and you stepped up, and I thought, wow, that's what big hitters do.
Well, that means a lot, man. I appreciate you saying that. And let me say this, too. I mentioned earlier in the show about my friend Tony Stemper, who caught that taco at that Greasy Meal show. I hope you know.
Tony!
Yeah, exactly. I hope you know how much you and the music you've played has meant to so many people over your lifetime. Keep feeding the river, man, because people love you, and I love you, too.
Right on back. Love you, bro.
There you have it. Episode 3 of Songs for the Cities. Thank you, XL Energy Center. And thank you, Mick Golden Light, for making this possible. Once again, my name is Chris Hockey. Tune in next week. One more edition, at least, of Songs for the Cities, right here on XLEnergyCenter.com. Take care, everybody. Keep feeding that river.